From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Like Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, with Guy Smith named as the long-term head of Milwaukee County's Parks Department, we'll talk with him about his vision for what's often termed the crown jewels of the county.
Later, auto contributor Mark Savage thinks back on the car features he used to write about, but doesn't anymore.
There were things like manual cranks on windows. Remember those? I used to mention this car has electric windows. Now I don't need to because they all have electric windows.
And sports writer George Dorman has seen a lot of obsessive sports fans in his time, but until recently, he never thought about what made them the fans they became.
You know, we sort of treat these people like circus freaks, right? It's like they're like behind this glass. They're these weird people. Maybe they're deranged. We make judgments about them. And so I really thought, you know, that can't be true, right? These have to be normal people somewhat.
Like Effect is next, but first the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It looks as though Milwaukee County Parks will finally have a permanent director. Late last week, County Executive Chris Abley appointed longtime Parks employee Guy Smith. Smith first needs the green light from the Parks, Energy, and Environment Committee at a Tuesday morning meeting, and then will require the full Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors' blessing.
Smith has experience at several levels within the parks. He joined the department in 2004, starting as trails coordinator. He quickly grew into supervision and management and transitioned to several roles within the department, including deputy regional manager of land resources and chief of operations. And when John Dargle resigned late last November, Smith was tapped to fill in as interim director.
Abley later named Jim Sullivan of the county's Child Support Services Department to top the park's post, but that idea faced stiff opposition and was withdrawn, putting Guy Smith back into the interim director role. Lake Effect's Susan Bentz sat down with Smith to talk about some of his priorities heading into the job. They met last Friday at Jacobus Park, where a traveling beer garden was being set up for the weekend.
So is this your dream job, or is it too soon to know?
No, this would be my dream job. I actually, it'll be 14 years that I've been here at Milwaukee County Parks in July. And I had always wanted to work in Milwaukee County Parks. My brother Chad is 12 years older than I am, so he went to Marquette for undergrad and actually grad school. But I grew up visiting him. So we'd go on the lakefront, we'd use the Oak Leaf Trail, and we'd go to Milwaukee County Parks all the time. So I've always been in the natural resource industry from a very young age, and worked for Dane County Parks all during college, worked for the Forest Service right after college, and I had been applying, frankly, to come here. And I actually got my first call for an interview for a forestry worker right around the graduation point and from college. However, I had already committed to go to the Forest Service. So I did my stint in the Forest Service, applied again, and was able to eventually get hired here in 2004, in July of 2004. So this is really a dream job.
So looking back at your Forest Service years, is that in a way an influence in how you approach this job, or is that very remote and very different?
So the experience that I got by working in the Forest Service, I think really propelled me, that training propelled me to be able to work here at Milwaukee County. The thing that I realized, though, is that although I very much love nature, I very much like people. And I felt that I wasn't able to make that great connection because Forest Service, although there's great people I worked with and great customers, it's a really large expanse. And so it's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of acres. And here, we're very blessed in Milwaukee County to have over 15,500 acres. But you have that urban, suburban, and even rural parks feel that we have. But yet you have that interaction with so many different people. And so that was kind of my draw here, is that I'm able to have kind of best of both worlds, to have that really cool community, and then also have that great resource in the parks.
So this job as director of Milwaukee County Parks is a huge honor, but it's also a big challenge. Deferred maintenance, for one.
Absolutely.
Just to start with.
Yeah. You are absolutely right. There are a lot of challenges, or also opportunities, depending on how you look at it. But yes, deferred maintenance, certainly making sure that we maximize our revenue options, I think we have had some really good partners, corporate partners, as well as friends groups, also volunteers and other creative things to help make things work. But we definitely, want to come together and find a way to help to address a lot of the maintenance and deferred maintenance issues.
So do you think has there been a really sort of deliberate big conversation around those issues? In other words, some people worry, on one hand, we have to tackle this deferred maintenance, we have to look to the future of the parks for accessibility for everybody. On the other hand, people have different opinions about that. And you've got business, you've got individuals, you've got parks friends. Do you envision trying to have conversations and not just one, two, or three, but a bunch to get deep into this?
I think that's a fair question, and yes, I think there's going to have to be a lot of conversations, and there's a lot of stakeholders. I'm optimistic that myself, as the director, can work closely with the legislative and executive branches together, also work with our budget staff, but then working with the community to really try to derive the best solution. And sometimes you got to think outside of the box. It's all right to reach out to other communities, municipalities within our own region and beyond to, ask, are there ways we can work together? I'll use an example that I have found to be very helpful is that MPS Recreation, City MKE Parks, so the city parks, and Milwaukee County Parks, we've been meeting on a quarterly basis and actually sharing best management practices, but also developing planning strategies. So Milwaukee County, we're working on our 2050 Parks and Open Space Plan with Sewer PAC. MPS Rec has been working on updating some of their strategic planning and equity planning. And City MKE has been working on some innovative things too. So what we're trying to do is look at where there's some gaps, are there duplication of services, are there things that we can work together on? And I think that's a really cool thing and something that we should be doing. And I think the leadership and the staff are open to it. So, MPS Rec is great because they provide some of the programmatic things in our parks that say we, the county, don't provide, but they're doing a playground program in several of our parks. I think it's just even some of those things where maybe it just seems a no-brainer, but that are coming together. And so I think that's a really good start.
So one of the debates, perhaps more recently, is the idea of the pay to park at county parks. What's your opinion on that idea? And, how do you feel about user fees in general?
Well, I think it is a fine line on what we want to provide, and I feel we do provide, is access to all. Obviously, our own, residents and folks within the county, but anyone. Visitors, tourists, etc. So we want to be able to provide that at low cost, and some of our things are no cost. It is hard to balance, with our difficult financial times. How is that the best way to work? And I think what it is back to your earlier question about those discussions, and I think those discussions where we have everyone at the same table. Working with the county board, working with the county exec, working with the budget office all together, I think is really a good step for that. I think also seeing things that have worked, whether it's traveling beer gardens or, some of our golf courses, and even what we're trying to do, and this ties into the funding thing, is rebrand ourselves so that we're not so institutional, but we're more parks are cool, parks are fun. Developing an online store, finding other ways to reach our community in maybe ways we haven't that can financially help us, but also maybe get that buy-in. So we're really trying to reach, bridge that gap, excuse me. So definitely need to be strategic and make sure that we have buy-in, with any new initiatives, and I think we've seen ones that have gone really well and ones that maybe didn't have the support, so then you go to the drawing board. But I'll tell you what, one of the things that I learned last year through the budget process, prior to me being interim, was just hearing some people good ideas, you know, and I think that's awesome. And then taking those to heart and trying to establish some of those.
County Exec Chris Abley has described you as a man of vision. Do you think you'll be given the opportunity to exercise that vision?
I do. I honestly do. And I would say that I have felt a lot of support during the last, I'd say, 6 months of being interim, where support from the executive and his staff and from the county board and their staff, from my own staff, frankly, and then just so many partners. I really have felt support and that I've been able to make decisions and be able to keep propelling things forward. So I really do feel that we're going to be able to do some great things.
So we spoke to a bit about friends groups. Those groups have strong feelings about maintenance and protecting.
Sure.
I think about people concerned about the Milwaukee River Greenway and the balance that was struck just recently at one of Milwaukee County's southernmost parks, Falk Park, which is rich in ephemeral wetlands and wildlife, and it happens to bump up to the new IKEA.
Sure.
You know, that was a balancing act.
Sure.
So... as you move forward, do you think, because of the richness of both the number and the quality of our parks, that you're going to need to prioritize, like go from one major issue to the next in terms of tending to the individual needs and qualities of each park? I mean, that seems undoable.
Well, what it comes down to is, and it's always a learning process for everyone, but I'm going from being the chief of operations, where I focused a lot on physically on how best to get things done. And what my staff, especially over the last few months, has allowed me to do is to be able to take a little bit step back and start thinking about that bigger vision, as we kind of started to talk about, to figure out what priorities we have to address now, what are some things, you know, 1 or 2 years down the road, what are we looking at for those 5-10 years down the road? And the reason that I mentioned the park and open space plan is because it's going to be very important to help us see Milwaukee County, and not just Milwaukee County parks, but all of the recreational and park amenities within it, to see what that actually physically looks like. And then, like I said, if there's gaps or if there's duplication, are there things that we can glean from that can help us in our capital project planning, but even our day-to-day operating? And then, you know, are there partners out there that can help us that we haven't even thought of yet? And so that's why having that plan will be helpful to us, and will provide some recommendations. And, you know, there might be ways that we can partner, you know, with MMSD or the DNR or folks that we haven't even thought of yet. So it is going to be hard to prioritize, but I think we're getting to a point where I'm able to start thinking about some of those bigger picture things, and be able to help drive that vision and my intent. What I have been starting to do, but now that you know, the process is moving forward, is to be able to make that vision clear to my staff, but obviously the general public too.
So I realize you're just catching your breath to start the job.
Sure.
But one day, what do you want your legacy to be?
Well, I want to leave the park system better than I found it. I want it to be the number one park system in the state, and frankly, I want it to be the number one park system in the country. And I know that I'm going to need to establish those, you know, those standards and, you know, goals to get there. One of the cool things about our system is that about 10,000 acres of the 15,000 are natural, and about 5,000 are active, and all of those things are very important. But as we continue to you know, expand our system, I want to be able to protect the environment as best as we can. And I think that the founders of our system were amazing to protect as many river corridors and as much of the lakefront as possible. But when we have unique opportunities to be able to protect you know, parts of environmental corridor or some of those things, or be able to provide services to folks that we haven't been able to do. Like one thing that I've been talking with various partners is wanting to have an all-inclusive playground that is something that able-bodied and non-able-bodied people of different ages, that it's just something that really is a destination. That's something that I really want to make happen. And so that's more of a what I hope to be an immediate thing, or at least within the next couple of years at least. But I see some areas for us to expand our opportunities. We've worked with Ramp Up Milwaukee to do accessible wheelchairs for, you know, Bradford Beach. We've worked with them for hand cycles. Just being able to, again, provide access to as many people as we can.
Guy Smith was named as next director of the Milwaukee County Parks Department, pending committee and full Board of Supervisors approval. He spoke with Susan Bentz.
A quick break now, and then our car contributors talk about the kinds of features they used to talk about on vehicles and what they might talk about down the road. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Do you remember the features that your first car sported? Did it have push-button transmission, an 8-track tape player, a crank sunroof? When you look at cars today, the list of optional and even standard features can be a mile long.
Lake Effect automotive contributors Dan Harmon and Mark Savage got to talking about the old days of options on cars and what the future might look like. Mark Savage says he remembers the features he used to review all the time when he started 30 years ago.
Obviously, I've been doing this for a long time now, 30-plus years, and reviewing the cars, the real cars. And technology has changed a lot in that time period. And things that I used to write about, I don't write about anymore because it's kind of common. And now things that are coming into existence, technology, especially electronics, I bet in 10 or 20 years I won't be mentioning that either, or someone won't be mentioning that at that point, because it just becomes commonplace and you expect it on cars. So, you know, things keep changing.
What are some of the things that you used to talk about a lot and that you don't anymore? And vice versa. I mean, we didn't really ever talk about technology, at least not in the same way that we do now about cars. So I'm wondering what's replaced. What you talk about technology now in reviews, but not other things. So what are those things that you don't talk about anymore?
Yeah, the things that have dropped away. The thing that really pops into my mind the most is anti-lock brakes, ABS. When I first started riding, a lot of the cars still had drum brakes or disc brakes in front and drum brakes in back. And then ABS was only on the luxury cars, the high-end cars. And now it's on everything, and most cars have disc brakes front and rear, so I don't even need to mention that anymore because you expect that on a car. Obviously, there were things like manual cranks on windows. Remember those? We actually had to wind our windows down instead of press a button. I used to mention this car has electric windows. Now I don't need to because they all have electric windows. I think I had one car this last year that did not have power windows.
Well, what was that?
I'm trying to remember. I just, as soon as I said that, you'd ask. I can't remember, but it was a low-priced car. It might have been a Hyundai or a Kia, the very low, smallest entry-level one. And then manual transmissions. I know you and I both like them, but a lot of the world doesn't care about manual transmissions anymore. I think it's only on about 2% of the cars, and most of those are sports cars or some sort of fancy car that you know, the performance is what it's about, so they put the stick in there. And it's kind of funny because these days the automatic transmission is up to 9 speeds in a lot of the cars now. They're so efficient, they're actually more efficient than the manual transmission. So there's no real reason for it except for the driving fun of having a manual transmission. So I don't know, though, manual anything is gone. I mean, I don't talk about anything being manual anymore because, you know, we used to have to slide the sunroof covers back. Now they're powered along with the sunroof. So I don't know. Unleaded gas, you know, it used to be that I would write if it took regular or unleaded. Well, it's all unleaded now. So if you have an old car that needs leaded gas, you're out of luck. It's hard to find that anymore.
I'd didn't think that was still even available.
No, I don't think
it is. I didn't see it anywhere.
Yeah, you probably have to get an additive to put into your older car to get that in there to help the cut down on that piston knock and stuff.
It's funny you mentioned, because I do have a manual transmission car, and when people see it, they their eyes light up in some cases. They think it's just either a novelty or they miss it. You know, they really miss those days when you could drive a manual.
Well, right, and I think that may be one of those retro things that may come back on a few cars, especially the Camaros and Mustangs and things like that, that people might want to play with them a little bit more instead of just put it in gear and let it go.
Wow, and things like central locking or being able to lock your car with your key fob or not even having to touch it in some cases.
Right, key fobs, who thought of having a key fob years ago? It was one or two keys you had, one for the doors, one for the ignition, one for the trunk. Now your little key fob does everything, or maybe not so little key fob. Seems like my key fobs are getting bigger and bigger that they have on these test cars. Sometimes they're almost like having another cell phone in your pocket.
Right. Well, maybe give us a bigger picture view, cars were no doubt simpler not that long ago, 20 years, 30 years. Do you think that they're better now? There's certainly more fun. There's more gadgets and things to play with and safety features for sure. Has this made, cars better, do you think?
Right. It's safety features and entertainment devices that we have in the cars now that have multiplied the electronics. I think the cars are definitely more user-friendly and easy to use, and probably for people who have at least slight handicaps, maybe that a lot of these things have helped them. Power seats certainly make it so that anybody of any size or shape can kind of squeeze into where they want to be or put the seat as far back as they want to be. So I think the cars are better, and they're certainly more reliable than they were back in the, certainly in the 60s, but in the 70s and 80s when I started doing this in the 80s. There used to be some bad cars I'd get, and you think, oh, man, this is not good at all. But there's very few cars that I would consider to be bad cars or not, high-quality cars these days. So I think the cars have definitely improved. Do all the devices help? I don't know. I think, to me, the biggest bugaboo I have in cars these days is the radio systems, because most of them are so hard to work if you're moving in the car. If you're going to sit in your driveway and take 5-10 minutes to figure out everything every morning and get it exactly the way you want, that's fine. But it used to be easy to turn on the radio, punch one of 5 or 6 buttons, and maybe we weren't as picky about the sound quality of the thing, so we don't have to tune in. Gee, am I going to have more of the speakers in the front seat, or am I going to balance it? Am I going to have my mid-range tuned up on it or what? I don't know. To me, that almost becomes a joke on a lot of the cars because it's so hard to do. I'll try and find 2 or 3 stations that I can toggle back and forth from, and some cars don't even have that now where you just have to roll the dial up and down. So if I'm listening to Sirius radio, which is kind of common in cars these days, satellite radio wasn't around years ago, and I want to listen to something, let's say the 70s on 7 that I want to listen to, and then I want to go to a comedy channel that's in the 90s, that's a lot of scrolling on that radio to get to that. So I don't know if that's easier, but it is wonderful that I have all those choices now in the cars. I don't know. Cars are just different, that's all. And the techie end of things just keeps growing.
Well, that's a perfect example of the question I want to ask you, which is, are there things standard now that you think are either get in the way or have become dangerous or aren't necessary and just add cost and aren't really things that should be there as a standard feature anyway?
Well, I'd say most of the safety devices obviously are good, and that's wonderful. The backup camera was one of the smartest things that ever happened, and I think the blind spot warning system is wonderful. The lane departure system, if it's something I can turn off in a car, I almost always do, because as you're driving around town, especially now that we're in construction season, you're always going over lines and around things, and so instead of having it beeping at you or trying to pull your car back into the lane, and you're thinking, no, I'm trying to get around the barricades that are sitting in the road. I don't think that's a necessary feature, and I think all the added gizmos that go along with the radios that just made it more difficult, and I don't necessarily think those are good. But GPS, you know, well, one, we've got it on our phone, but a lot of the cars, that's standard now. It's nice to have, especially if you're on a trip and you're going someplace that you're not familiar with. You can, you know, punch that in and at least see down the road a little ways where you may be headed. Satellite radio is unnecessary but fun. Some of the other new devices that have come in that I probably won't be writing about in 5 years from now because they'll be standard is the automatic lights, because almost everything has automatic lights now that turn on during the day or night whenever it feels that they're necessary. And now they have lights that the bright lights turn on at night if you need them. You don't have to keep punching a button or turning a knob to get that to happen. And lights that bend and go around the corners as your car turns a corner. That's a nice feature when you're out in the country or out on a dark road. Gives you a little bit more visibility as you go around that corner. That's neat. Remote start is nice. I don't use it on any of the cars that I have. I don't know why. I just never seem to think about doing that. But I think in the wintertime, that's particularly nice. I know people in our office that stand at the window and point the thing out front and start their car up and get it warmed up before they head out when it's really cold.
Well, let me flip it around a little bit and ask you, what is just gone from today's cars that was something you used to talk about a lot?
Well, that's interesting because I don't know there's too much that's just gone other than the things that used to be manual and now are power, like the windows and the seats and so forth. I mean, you know, what's gone is, again, a lot of radio buttons to select the five channels you want. All the trunks are now powered. You don't have to press – you can just press a button instead of walking outside to do that. You know, just nothing jumps to mind that things are gone. It's more things that we have added, like airbags. There's, you know, used to be only – when I started, there was only driver's side airbags. Then it was all front seat airbags. Now there's side airbags and roof airbags and all sorts of things that will pop out. And just manual door locks. You know, you used to have to push those down. Now you punch a button or the car, when you put it in gear, it automatically locks the car for you. So I don't know. I guess nothing just pops to mind a lot that we don't have anymore. It's just the customization and automation of everything that we used to have, plus the addition of all the electronics that just are kind of almost overwhelming at times.
Well, a lot of these things are standard or going to become standard, what are you going to talk about now if we can't just keep talking about new things?
Well, I'm guessing that there'll be some more new electronic things that come in on the cars that you need to mention until they become standard on everything. Something that, you know, I've been seeing more of the last couple of years is the stop-start technology. And when I take people for rides in my cars and that they have not been in a new car lately, they're shocked when we pull to a stoplight and it stops and the engine turns off. And they go like, what's wrong with your car? So that's something that is just, you know, probably in 25% of the cars that are out there now, but it'll be growing and growing, and we'll get used to that, like anti-lock brakes and so forth. So, you know, there's always something it seems like we have to write about, but it is mostly electronics now. It's, as you and I have talked about in the past, we don't worry about the styling so much because so much is similar. It'd be nice to have some better styling on cars, but that doesn't change all that much. And again, as we think of more safety devices and autonomous cars, you know, they're coming our way, whether we like it or not. They are, you know, slowly progressing. It might be that I don't have to review cars anymore, that they're all pretty much the same. They're just an appliance that gets you to and from where you're wanting to go. And it may be that you don't even own a car. You'll call Uber or text Uber, I should say, and they'll come and pick you up in a little pod and take you to work and take you home. You'll only worry about whether the Uber car is comfortable or whether it's got a nice seat and enough plug-ins for all of your devices that you're going to plug in as you let it drive you down the highway.
And worry about whether or not it's going to take out a pedestrian or someone on a bicycle.
Right. And that's it's coming. I know we've had the Uber car that was autonomous and ran over someone recently, but now they're starting to say it doesn't look like it was really the car's fault that it didn't see this person crossing the road. You know, they will be programmed to watch for things, but they don't expect somebody to jump in front of your car, as the case may be, or stumble in front of your car. Yeah, I think autonomous cars, I don't know. I still think it's going to be another 10 years before we see them regularly coming out, kind of like electric cars have been slower to come out than the hybrids because they made sense and you could get to the gas station and fill up and extend your range. But autonomous cars are going to be here, and then, yeah, we'll just be plugging in our iPhones or whatever we have, and it'll be like the old Greyhound. We'll leave the driving to them.
Well, are these the things that are going to feature heavily in reviews for you is either new driver aid technology, and the other part is, of course, what propels cars. That's going to be evolving quite a bit the next few years.
Well, right, and that's what I do write more about all the time is whatever electronics have been added, and whether it's a hybrid car, a plug-in hybrid, or you know, a mixed hybrid where you can fill it up with gas, or something like the Volt that is gasoline that powers your batteries that keeps you running. That's what we'll be writing about, at least for the foreseeable future anyway, and we'll see what comes after that. Maybe we'll be like the Jetsons, and we'll have a briefcase that folds up into, you know, that turns into my little jet that takes me back and forth from home to work.
With all this technology, it's easy to get nostalgic. I'm wondering if you have any pains or a little tinge of nostalgia when you look back at cars that were more simple, and you just get in and put your station on and drive.
It is fun to think about that from time to time. And our car was damaged, and had to be in the shop for a little while. And we had a loaner car it was a late 90s. I believe it was a Toyota or Honda at the time, and it was fun. I could, you know, turn the dial and find the radio station, plug it in. The windows were crank. It was kind of fun, although the ride was pretty horrible. But the car itself was just kind of fun to drive because it was so simple and easy. And like I said, you had your own key, you stuck it in the ignition, and away you went. And there's a little nostalgia for that, and you know that's probably why. Vintage cars will still be popular. You know, those 80s, 90s, 2000, early 2000 cars will be popular in 20 years because people will say, that was fun. I didn't have to program everything when I got into it.
Maybe what's the one thing you miss the most? Even though cars are better today, they're safer, but what is something that you wish for, I guess, or if you could have something from the past?
I know I'm being repetitive, but a simple radio that I can just punch a button and put it on. You know, how many of us listen to 25 stations? Most of us have four or five, maybe two local stations that you're going to listen to. And maybe if you have Sirius, you might have three or four other channels that you want to listen to. But I mean, come on, let's don't make this hard. I shouldn't have to think that much when I get in my car just to turn a radio on and turn the station to what I want.
Well, Mark, thank you for coming back on.
That's all right. Hopefully next time we'll have even something new and exciting in the electronics world to tell you about in a car.
I'm sure we will. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Mark Savage writes the auto review column, Savage on Wheels, for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and SavageOnWheels.com. He's also editor of Scale Auto Magazine, part of Kalmbach Publishing in Waukesha. He joins contributor Dan Harmon regularly to talk about cars.
There are sports fans, and then there are sports fans. Why do some people seem to go over the top when it comes to supporting the Packers or the Brewers or even the Portland Timbers soccer team? We'll get some insight when Like That continues in a moment on WUWM.
The little things I could get in my big lunchbox, like nuts and bolts and all four shocks, but the big stuff we snuck out my buddy's mobile home.
More of Lake Effect Now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Anyone who watches sports, either in person or on TV, has seen a certain group of people. The fans sitting in Lambeau Field on a 15-degree December day with their shirts off, chests covered in green and gold paint. Or the guy driving down the street in a car painted in the Brewers color scheme, with Brewers license plates, of course.
The term fan doesn't seem adequate to describe how some people connect to a sports team. Writer George Dorman would have you use the term superfan. Dorman is a Pulitzer Prize-winning sports writer and author of the recent book, Superfans: Into the Heart of Obsessive Sports Fandom, a trip that connected him with two Wisconsinites who clearly fall into that category. Dorman joined us via Skype from Oregon earlier this spring. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So what got you first thinking about the obsessive nature of some sports fans?
You know, I just think I've been a journalist, a sports journalist for a long time at Sports Illustrated, at newspapers, and you know, you interact with a lot of fans as a result of that. Fans who are happy you wrote something, angry you wrote something, fans who accuse you of bias, you know, all these sort of interesting interactions that you have. And it only feels like with social media and whatnot, we are hearing more from fans than ever. And so I just really wanted to gain a deeper understanding of the people that I was, you know, that I was hearing from all the time. And, you know, and also myself, because I'm a fan. So it was also a little bit of, even though I'm not really in the book, a little bit of understanding myself.
Well, right. I mean, you have been around this long enough, and you write about other people who kind of have experienced these same things. You write about Buster Olney, who, you know, turns out to be biased towards, you know, or against 28 of 30 Major League Baseball teams. Did you have a certain group of assumptions about these folks that brought you into this project?
I think that one thing it was more of a curiosity, which was, you know, we sort of treat these people like, some of them at least, like circus freaks, right? It's like they're like behind this glass. They're these weird people. Maybe they're deranged. You know, we make judgments about them. And so I really thought, you know, that can't be true, right? These have to be normal people somewhat. So I went in it thinking, look, there has to be a normal side to these people. And that proved to be true. I think there was, on my end, you know, really a strong desire to get to know the people behind the face paint and the costumes and all that.
You do write about them with a fair amount of affection as you get to know them, which I think, you know, for people who were expecting this to be a freak show might come as a surprise. But, you know, there really is something endearing about just about everyone in this book.
Yeah, you know, I think that part of that comes from going out and seeing them and sitting down with them and not just focusing on their fandom, but also focusing on, tell me about your life, your wife, your husband, your job, your history. I mean, when you're talking to somebody who is, let's say there's a woman in my book who is just an insane Seattle Seahawks fan, like to the point that she has superstitions about what kind of Skittles she has next to her when she's watching the game, right? That on the face of it, and if you just talk to her about that, she comes across as a little bit off. But then you talk to her about her substance abuse problem. She was in an abusive relationship. Why she was drawn towards the Seahawks and why she embraces them so much. You can't help but look at that and offer at least a more balanced portrait of who these individuals are.
So the guy that seems pivotal to understanding what it means to be an intense sports fan is a man named Dan Wan. What does his research represent in this field?
Dan is at Murray State in Kentucky, and he's really the one guy who has been allowed to make a career out of studying fans. And he's been doing it for 20 plus years. It started when he was at a doctorate program at Kansas. So most fan researchers kind of do it as a sidelight, but Dan is the one guy who does it full time and has published, you know, over 100 papers about this. So this is the one guy, he's a social psychologist who spends, you know, most of his waking days or his professional waking days, just thinking about researching and studying fans. So he is really the key to doing this. And one reason in particular, which is Dan developed a method to actually sort of rate fandom. We have this idea of how big a fan are you? People hear that all the time and there's contests and nonsense. Dan actually has a scientific approach how to do this. He has a test that he gives fans to show how strongly they identify with teams.
Right. It's called the Sports Spectator Identification Scale. And I was amazed. He apparently sketched it out, what, over dinner or something. It was really pretty. It came to him pretty easily.
Yeah. And it really changed the profession, because before Dan, all the researchers who did, research on fans, in Dan's words, number one, they didn't really like fans or weren't fans, whereas Dan's a huge Kansas fan, a huge Murray State fan, a huge Royals fan. So that's the first part of it. And the second part of it is they treated all fans equally. If you're a fan of, you know, the Green Bay Packers, you're just a fan. It's all the same. But what if you only watch the Green Bay Packers on Sunday with friends and don't think about them otherwise? You know, how is that fan the same as somebody who lives and dies with them every day, all week, reads every blog, you know, writes his own blog, visits message boards, things like that. So Dan brought to the research was the idea of treating every fan individually and getting a sense of how each fan, how strongly each fan identified with the team.
The other part of his work that seems especially significant is he also helps pinpoint what or who is most responsible for turning people on to sports, right?
Yeah, and I think by doing so, he and some other research has have shattered some of the myths we have about fandom. But, you know, he goes out and he asks a lot of college students, typically college students, you know, why did you become a fan? And what he found was that there's some obvious ones. Oh, you know, my dad was a fan of that team, so I became a fan. Or my older brother was a fan of that team. But it goes way beyond that. And there are a myriad of reasons. And what you find is that people typically have many reasons for why they are a fan. Maybe they went to college there. Maybe their dad went there. Maybe they just liked birds growing up as kids and therefore became an Eagles fan, right? So he found out that really it's kind of complicated why people choose teams. And the bigger one is that he and some other researchers in Australia really, I think, shattered a myth. And that's the myth that women become fans through what an Australian researcher calls sexually transmitted fandom, right? Which is that, you know, somehow women become fans because their husbands or boyfriends are fans. They really shattered that, and they found that most women become fans in the same manner that men become fans, which is typically a family member introduced them to a team.
There's a Packers fan who kind of fits into this dynamic and kind of builds off of Dan's work. Where does Ted Peetz come in?
Yeah, Ted is a Wisconsinite, and he then went into academia. He traveled around a lot, worked at different colleges. He's worked in Ohio, Iowa, Nevada. He's now at Belmont University in Tennessee. And he was somebody who, and people can relate to this, Packers fans certainly can, who every stop he went looking for other Packers fans to watch games with and to connect with. So he'd find that Packers bar in a tiny town in Ohio, right? Or find the big one, the Rum Runner in Las Vegas. And he started thinking about, well, why do I do this? Why am I, what psychologically is going on here? And what does it bring to my life? And then, of course, he ran into Dan Wann at a conference. And Dan sort of brought him into his orbit, and they started crafting research, a research project around this. And so Ted went out and started, you know, polling and testing, giving different tests and questionnaires to the Packer fans that he interacted with at bars, at one specific bar, but two bars actually, in Tennessee. And what he realized was that mostly what was happening with Packer fans was something called place attachment, which is that Packer fans really wish they were back in Wisconsin. And so when they are gathering outside a bar in Nashville and grilling brats, and tailgating at the bar before the bar opens, by the way, to then go inside and watch it. What they really just want the smells of home, the sounds of home, maybe the accents of somebody. They want to hear about home. And this is called place attachment. And it's something that's been studied. It was actually studied by a guy who studied Nebraska football fans. But Ted then took it a step further and said, hey, are Green Bay Packers fans happy when the off season? Is it in the off season, are they as happy as they are in the regular season? And he did all this work on it, and the conclusion was yes, that Packers fans, this place attachment, this connection that they make during the season, these groups that they form, creates a very lasting happiness.
Right, it's interesting. Like the research is there that shows sports fans are generally just happier people than non-sports fans.
And I think there's several reasons for that. One is, you know, they create social groups. We're social individuals. We want to be part of groups. And so fan groups are these really interesting social groups that help us connect with people. Two, you know, your team wins and you feel good. Your team signs a top free agent, you feel good.
Right. This is burging, right?
Yeah, exactly. You're basking in reflected glory. So that's, you know, self-esteem. It's a big boost to our self-esteem to be in a fan group. It also helps our self-esteem, and this may be a little bit unfortunate, when our rival, you know, loses a top free agent or blows a draft pick or those sort of things. So, you know, generally speaking, you know, what Dan and other researchers have found is that fans are happy people, that fandom, even pretty intense fandom, is not necessarily a negative thing. And for a lot of people, it's a real positive in their lives.
Although you do write about one researcher who writes with some concern about the age at which kids are exposed to their parents, generally their dad's fandom, and what it's teaching them.
This was a really eye-opening bit of research for me, diving into this notion of really getting into how do young children react to fandom, to being indoctrinated into a team. The boy in my book is in a Packers family. They live in Chicago, but they're huge Packers fans. The dad had season tickets, is from Wisconsin originally, but he grew up an Eagles fan because he loved birds. And, you know, we see him videos of him melting down as Tom Brady is beating his Eagles, a couple years ago. And what this researcher that I talked to, Susan Harder, who's a renowned child psychologist, talked about was how, you know, one problem with introducing kids to fandom is that they already want to see the world in black and white. Kids just naturally want good and bad. They want girl and boy. The example she used was a kid might say, is this a girl street or a boy street? And that's something that those of us who have kids can certainly understand, kids wanting that clarity, that very simplified black and white world. Well, fandom creates that for them, right? Alabama good, Auburn bad, right? You know, Notre Dame good, USC bad, or whatever you want to, you know, apply it to anything, right? We can do it. Bears good, Packers bad, that kind of a thing. And so the problem is kids embrace that wholeheartedly. And they also don't understand sort of any nuance to it. So the Eagles might finish, you know, with one loss during the regular season. They might make it to the Super Bowl and they might lose. But that kid is going to melt down. He's not going to understand, well, we had a good season overall, so it's okay, you know. And he also is not going to understand family reactions. So his dad, when the Packers lost the Seahawks in that famous NFC Championship game, that crushing defeat, the dad was curled up on a ball in the bed, melting down. That 5, 6, 7-year-old kid doesn't understand that daddy's going to be okay, that daddy's just having an emotional moment. He thinks his dad is really hurting and in pain. And so what was really fascinating to me was that this woman, this child psychologist, essentially said, we shouldn't be introducing fandom to our kids until adolescence. Because at that point, they can then understand, you know, daddy isn't really going to, you know, isn't really losing it. And they can understand that we had a good season despite the loss. And we have to understand that while we may not like Tom Brady, that doesn't make him, you know, evil and worth our scorn.
I'm also really interested in this concept of standing out but still fitting in, because you spent a lot of time with a Brewers fan who is actually known as Teddy Kervin, but better known as the Rally Banana, this guy who wears a banana costume to Brewers games. And you write that he is emblematic of this phenomenon of being the same and different at the same time.
Oh, I love Teddy Kervin. He is seriously, well, I mean, if I had to pick one fan in this book that I just like so much, it is him. Because this is like a bar owner's son from outside Milwaukee who went to UW Milwaukee and he just, you know, kind of on a drunken lark with his college buddies started wearing this banana costume to games, and he ended up on TV across the country, you know, grabbing his love handles. And I mean, it's unbelievable. There's video out there. Any listener should go find it, you know, the Rally Banana on YouTube. But what Teddy is somebody who needs a high level of distinctiveness. And the way I describe it is all individuals have these two competing needs. One is to be part of a group, and the other is to stand out from the group. Some people don't need to stand out from the group much. They're happy being in the group, standing out very little or not at all, right? But other people really need to stand out from the group. They still want to be part of that group that is Brewers fans or Lakers fans or whatever. But they also, like, I'm an individual and I want to make sure everybody knows I'm an individual. And, you know, Teddy is a guy who competed in, like, competitive karaoke contests wearing nothing but a Speedo. This is clearly a man who has a high need for distinctiveness. So why does Teddy Kervin go to Brewers games and lift up his shirt and shake his belly and scream Rally Banana and do it on TV with his wife sitting next to him, by the way? And, like, why does he do this? And the answer is he's just somebody who really needs that distinctiveness, needs to stand out while also kind of fitting in. So, you know, this makes him happy. And so we can sit there and we can judge Teddy and we can say, my God, I would never do that. Well, I'm not somebody that needs that level of distinctiveness, but Teddy does. And he's doing no harm other than maybe kind of making us turn away from the TV every once in a while. But he is very happy. I mean, he has a great job. He's happily married. He's got the house, the dog, the whole thing. He is a happy guy. And that happiness, it comes in part from him having this very unique distinctiveness that he can express at Brewers games.
So you said you went into this project thinking about yourself as a sports fan. Did you come out of it understanding any more about where you come from as the sports fan that you are?
Oh, yeah, several things. I mean, it definitely influenced that chapter we talked about child, introducing your child to fandom. I have kids 5 and 8, and it made me really think about differently about how much I will introduce them to my own fandom at this point. So I hide a little bit of my fandom from them. I watch games out of the house so they don't see me yelling at the TV or things like that. Just I don't want them to see that emotion from me, because they just can't understand that it's no big deal that dad's yelling at the TV. He's not really mad, you know? But I think a lot of little things. I think if the book succeeds with readers, I think it would be because readers will learn little things about themselves and about the people around them. And I've learned little things about, you know, I went to Notre Dame. Why do I downplay Notre Dame's chances before every game? I call my buddies and I'm sitting there thinking, oh God, you know, they got no chance against Michigan State. You know, there's no way. It's just another loss. Brian Kelly's terrible. Well, I'm preparing my self-esteem. I'm preparing myself for the blow that will come when, you know, so there's a lot of little things like that that I learned about my own behavior, superstitions, you know, those kind of things that really have helped me. You know, I can now do something as a fan and go, oh, I'm doing this because for this reason.
Well, George Dorman, it's great stuff. And I think, honestly, a lot of people will recognize a little something of themselves in many parts of this book. So thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you for having me. It's been great.
George Dorman is senior editor of The Athletic, a former investigative reporter for Sports Illustrated, and author of the new book, Superfans, Into the Heart of Obsessive Sports Fandom. We reached him on the line from Oregon, and our interview first aired in March. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Tomorrow on the show, we'll get some analysis on the results from Wisconsin's special elections happening today, plus learn the appeal of urban beekeeping and urban chicken coops.
Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.